This was a grotesque, one-sided beatdown. It's one thing to lose and try, but the Cavs didn't even show up. It was a disgusting display, you know, that kind of thing.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome. This is Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports. I'm Neil Payne, jack of all sporting trades here at 538, and I'll be hosting this week with our regular host Chad Matlin away on assignment or something. On the line, we also have Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist, and she's coming to us this week from
Bristol, Connecticut.
Beautiful Bristol, Connecticut. Wow, what brings you up there? Just the usual TV taping craziness?
I am filling in for Bob Lee on Outside the Line.
Wow, look
nice.
At you.
Yes.
That's some real journalism. That's
that
not
is the
like what
opposite of hot taking.
Yeah, exactly. The antithesis of hot taking. Well, Chad is not here. We have somebody almost as good. In fact, I would argue better. Kevin Arnovitz, a staff writer from ESPN.com. And he is on the line from L.A., right?
I am in Los Angeles.
How's the weather out there?
It is 78 and sunny.
As always.
He's way better than Chad. Kevin is like two tiers above Chad.
Yeah. So Chad, if you're listening to your podcast feed kind of unsuspectingly, you're going to get blindsided a few times. This may not be the last time, but you'll roll with it. So on today's show, first of all, we're going to talk about the NBA Finals, of course. Two games in, the Cavs are in huge trouble. The Warriors have them down 2-0, and they've been beating them by 48 combined points, which is a new finals record for margin of victory through the first two games of a series. We'll break down what went wrong for Cleveland and whether they have any shot at all at a comeback. Then we're going to pay tribute to the late Muhammad Ali, who passed away Friday night. Ali was known as the greatest, but is there any way to really quantify that statistically? Or is boxing a sport where analytics are particularly poorly suited to measure greatness? And finally, we're going to talk about soccer. The Copa America kicked off last week here in the U.S., and the host team already lost its first match. Is this a last stand for American coach Jurgen Klinsmann? Should it be? We're going to be joined by ESPN FC's Mike Goodman, and he'll tell us all about the tournament. And then finally, there's no Sig Dig this week, but we're going to bring you an extra special segment on the meaning of the hot take, a topic that is near and dear to all of our hearts here at Hot Takedown. So first up, the NBA Finals. The Warriors have utterly destroyed the Cavs in games 1 and 2, and lots of people are really disappointed with Cleveland's execution and effort. Here's Mad Dog Sports Radio's Adam Schein telling us exactly how he feels on the subject.
A disgrace, a pathetic joke, an embarrassment, another beatdown in the NBA Finals. Game one was lopsided. Game two was a no-show. It's one thing if you lose big in a sporting event. It's another thing if you don't even bother to show up. A hapless, grotesque, embarrassing, pathetic no-show by the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm just repulsed. This Cleveland team just didn't even give a damn. I don't even think Steve Kerr, when he looks at the game film, is going to say, wow, we played a great game. They didn't. The Cavaliers should be embarrassed.
Wow, that was a hot take. That was superheated. That may have been the most superheated take we've ever run here on Hot Takedown. So I have to ask, is he right? Has this just been a matter of Cleveland not showing up at all and not being prepared? Or are the Warriors doing something special to shut down LeBron James and the Cavs?
Well, Neil, I think when somebody says, like, it's so heated that it was a grotesque performance, for me, I have to leap to the idea that they weren't putting in any effort. And now you can argue about whether Cleveland's effort right now is very smart effort, but there's no lack of actual physical effort on the court from them. What I'm seeing more so is for some reason they seem to be unable to make any sort of adjustment that is tricky for the Warriors in any way. Like, it's like game one, you have Kyrie Irving getting torched by Livingston for 20 points, and basically whoever Kyrie Irving is guarding, the Warriors are going to go at. And then in game two, Cavaliers' adjustment, I guess, is to kind of send a quick double team and leave Draymond Green wide open. And I'm not saying that these aren't like smart adjustments at like the high school and college level. It just seems like for the NBA Finals, I thought in game two, after watching Kyrie Irving on defense seemed to be picked apart by the Golden State Warriors, that you would see the Cavaliers come out with something on the defensive side of the ball that was a little more creative than what we ended up seeing.
There's a part of me that feels like we're all watching Wild Kingdom and yelling at the TV, like, at the prey. Like, why can't you outrun the cheetah? Like, I mean, basically for the better part of 6 months, all three of us have been on various platforms talking about this is the most historically accomplished team, at least in the regular season of all time. And Cleveland is your pedestrian Eastern Conference champion, that in which tends to happen over there. And sort of this, what have we learned? And I mean, to Kate's point, we've learned that Kyrie Irving's a really lousy pick and roll defender at the point of sort of at the point of action. And that remains true. We've learned that Golden State presents problems of versatility, whereby they've got, first of all, they've got four, at sometimes when they have their lineup of death on the floor, five guys who can move the ball and make plays. And it's funny because we've been talking about the small ball revolution for a while now. But I think the thing that people miss about Golden State is actually once you get past Curry and Thompson, there are a lot of guys you're comfortable with shooting from distance, including Draymond Green, though he hit five of them in game two. What they don't account for is actually, I think, the sort of the next wave of the small ball revolution is, well, actually, you have five guys who can almost effectively function as point guards. And so what it does to a defense trying to defend them is you just can't – you have to be prepared basically to cover five triple threats. Guys who can shoot, guys who can pass, guys who can drive and put the ball on the floor, which is when you essentially have Curry, Thompson, Barnes, Iguodala, and Green on the floor as a unit, which is the lineup of death. Like they're essentially 15 threats. I mean, we're talking about five by triple. And I mean, that's essentially what's happening. So on one hand, I think it's ludicrous to say Cleveland didn't show up. I mean, they showed up and they played poorly. And their defensive strategy of basically taking away shots from Thompson and Curry and then letting everyone else beat you, I don't dismiss out of hand as a bad game plan. I mean, there are no good game plans against the Warriors. They just executed it really poorly, and they communicated very poorly behind those sort of traps and blitzes to the point where actually at a certain point in game two, they just kind of called off the dogs and then were grasping at straws. At one point, they had a lineup with LeBron at the five, and then a few minutes later, they were essentially with Mozgov and Thompson. So I don't think they know what to do at this point.
Yeah, and I think to that point, Kevin, about the the difference between, for instance, the Cavs were almost as much of a shooting team, certainly in the playoffs. They really rode distance shooting throughout the Eastern Conference, but they don't seem to have any kind of extra sort of fallback when that isn't going right for them. Whereas the Warriors are so much more than their shooting that, yeah, that kind of grabs all the headlines. But then they also, like you said, have all of these players who are so versatile and so able to kind of break down defenses in different ways that if you do, like you said, Kate, if you assign pressure to certain areas and try to shut down certain aspects of them, they can just respond in a different way. And maybe this illustrates how Cleveland is almost like an empty version of that game plan of just like shoot a bunch of threes and hope for the best, but not really have a backup plan if a team really takes that away.
And Neil, I'd like to know your thoughts on Iguodala's defense on LeBron, because I forget what the exact numbers are, but LeBron's points per 100 possessions going into the matchup with Iguodala was at such a level. Of course, it was such a LeBron effectiveness level. And Iguodala seems to be holding him to, I forget what it was, maybe like 80-something points per 100 possessions, like much, much lower. It's hard to know whether that's a function specifically of Iguodala's defense, which I know has always been phenomenal on the ball against like swingmen types. Or is it a function of the Cavaliers' offensive game plan feeling like it's stalled in a lot of ways?
Yeah, I think it's probably a little bit of both, because if you look at LeBron, you know, when he's on the court against Iguodala, the Cavs as a whole are minus 38 points per 100 possessions, and certainly LeBron isn't doing great, but then you look at the rest of the roster and you kind of see that he's also not getting a lot of help. I mean, he's having to assist on something like 60% of his teammates' baskets while he's in the game and also do a lot of the rebounding load and lead the team in usage rate at the same time. So in some ways, they're actually, I don't know why this is possible or how, you know, things have gotten to this point for them, but they're asking him to do sort of as much as he was doing last year successfully in the finals. And we saw him, you know, carry them to two wins against the Warriors. But how can this more talented supporting cast actually be providing him in some ways less support than the team that they rolled with last year?
It was weird not to see Fry on the floor just because, you know, one of the things they rode coming in, I mean, they won their first 10 playoff games this season, they ended up, what, 12-2, was this notion, and you would hear it on the broadcast, like, David Griffin, take a bow. You know, what a great filling out of the roster this season. And in some ways, I think that was very much a response to the Warriors, is we need to have the versatility and the stretch to compete with a Golden State team when we get to the finals. You can't just leave it as, oh, we'll have to bench Mozgov and, hey, let's just grab any warm body. That you needed players like Fry, and it was interesting because he didn't really get on the floor much in Game 2. And I think Tyronn Lue had told Doris Burke, you know, according to reports, that, well, they liked the look of Jefferson kind of against that lineup of death a little more. But it's just a little strange to me just because Fry, not only for being the hottest three-point shooter in the playoffs, if you abide by Hot Hand, and that's a different conversation for a different podcast, I guess, Neil. but, you know, it's just strange because, you know, Fry was this guy that gave them this new dimension they didn't have.
Yeah, and it seems like they went away, one, from what had gotten them to the NBA Finals. Now, you can say they would get to the NBA Finals really regardless of game plan, but a lot of it was Channing Fry shooting a lot of threes, opening up the floor and playing that kind of spread offense that Neil alluded to earlier, and they got away from that strategy, and they've gotten away from what was at least mildly effective in the NBA Finals last year, is like playing some bigger guys, like playing more Mozgov and more Thompson, but at least we saw Mozgov in Game 2. It's like the discussion now is kind of veered toward, do we think the Warriors can even sweep?
Right.
And I was looking at the numbers because, you know, it was like basically every team that's gone down 0-2 historically, and I know we all have these numbers in front of us, like a third of them were then swept, 30% lost in five games, 23% lost in six, seven actually forced Game 7, and then 7% won the whole series. And, Neil, I was wondering, because I know the 538 model says that the Cavaliers have an 11% chance to win the series, but the historic numbers that I just read, I guess, show that over the course of history, only 7% of teams who have been down 0-2 came back to win the entire series. Why are the Cavs 4 percentage points higher?
Well, I think it probably speaks to their resume going into the series. You know, they did put up a really strong season and a really strong playoff push, and now we kind of are left looking at that and saying how much of that was just the East was so much easier compared to the West, and wondering if Cleveland would have even, you know, advanced, it would have even won a series in the West, for instance. But I think also, you know, when we looked at some of the numbers yesterday on teams that fall down in what seems like a really deep hole, like not only down 2-0, but also just getting destroyed in those first two games, there actually wasn't that much of a relationship between the degree to which you get crushed in the first two games and your ability to kind of push the series at least to a fifth game or a sixth game. And one of the interesting things is, if we're looking at Cleveland and saying, how are they even going to win a game, is you can look back to the previous series that Cleveland played and look at Toronto and look at how badly Cleveland outclassed them in the first two games, which were also road games for the underdog, in this case the Raptors. They actually got beat worse than Cleveland did over the first two games of the finals, and yet they still managed to win not just one game but two games. So it does kind of underscore how these things can flip on a dime, but in the end also it kind of shows that maybe the best that Cleveland can hope for in this series is to win one or two games. Like, two games might be like an accomplishment from this point.
Yeah. And I'll say, just playing devil's advocate, you know, insofar as, if you want to look at outliers, at Game 1, Sean Livingston basically hits a ton of contested long two-pointers for a guy who's not a shooter. Kind of end of story. Leandro Barbosa, you know, throws in a few of his own. And then Game 2, you know, I looked at the shot quality. information that we have. And actually, the funny thing about Draymond Green is his shot quality in game two was lower than his season average, lower than his first three-round average. And ultimately, I mean, the guy – and it's tough because there were like three or four shots that he was wide freaking open from three-point land. But actually, in aggregate, he outperformed the kind of shot expectancy too. So on one hand, if you want to play devil's advocate, a lot of things went right for the mm-hmm. Warriors. Then on the other hand, on the third mm-hmm. hand, like, you know, Curry, who, by the way, they were able to sort of bottle him up. I mean, if you want to give the Cavs sort of the participation ribbon for anything, it is – they sought to make life a little bit more difficult for Steph Curry, and they did make life a little bit more difficult for Steph Curry. On the other hand, he's a guy who excels even when life is made difficult for him. And so on the fourth hand, well, okay, Curry
at some
point is
going
to have
–
I am an octopus. And they don't have hands, though. They have those little suctions, right?
Suction
like little tentacle thingies. At any rate, so – yeah, I mean, there are a lot of variables, but we still have not seen the Steph game, the patented sort of trademark signature Steph game.
And we still haven't really seen a LeBron game either in terms of like the type of thing that we've seen from him. Is the only path for the Cavs back in this series maybe if he just gets really, really hot, like maybe 2007 against Detroit hot? Like, I don't know what it would take. What would it take for Cleveland to come back?
I mean, I would look to, yes, LeBron having one of those put the team on his back game, but they've yet to have a game really over the last four, going back to the end of the Toronto series, where you really saw a three-point explosion from even other guys like J.R. Smith. And as Kevin mentioned earlier, Channing Frye, like there just has not been that kind of help. And you could see how if LeBron was like, look, we're winning this first game at home and I'm going to the rim every single time and I'll kick out when I absolutely have to. And you get a guy like J.R. Smith and like Channing Frye hitting like four or five threes each. Well, then you can, of course, see the Cavaliers winning.
Yeah, I'm with Kate on this one. I don't think there is a Detroit performance. I mean, forgetting the fact, I don't think there's one in LeBron. He's just older. I think their best chance to win is you'll look at the box score and it'll be like LeBron with 14 assists. You know, it's that recipe you said earlier where essentially they're relying on him to provide that sort of facilitation. And it's going to be, right, like a 7 for 11 from a 3 game from J.R. Smith. It's going to be Channing Frye getting back on the floor and being effective. It's going to be, well, they were able to somehow exploit some kind of size advantage by, you know, the Warriors got like, I think, almost a third of their offensive rebounds on Sunday night. Like, that can't happen. And so, okay, they parlay that size into really limiting Golden State to, you know, beneath 20% on the offensive glass, therefore taking away possessions. And also, by the way, it would help if they get a freaking stop, because I think part of their offensive problems is they're just walking the ball up court, which allows, you know, all those Golden State defenders, even when they are undersized, to have a foot in the paint. They just shrink the floor really well. They don't even need rim protection because they are so effective at switching on the perimeter. And that versatility works defensively as well as it does offensively. But I think actually the good LeBron game, I would look at the assist column. Like, to me, that's – I don't know that he has a Detroit 07 performance in him.
All right. So let's leave it there. I'm sure we're going to revisit this, hopefully, if the series goes longer and becomes more interesting. But even if not, if it ends in a sweep, we'll be back next week to have more things to say about the finals. So now let's move on to Muhammad Ali. All corners of the sports world were saddened Friday night when news came that the great fighter had died at age 74. It led to a great deal of outpouring of grief and tributes for the man that many came to know as the greatest. So I have to first ask you guys, what was your reaction when you first heard about his passing? This is kind of a historic figure in the history of sports and one of the biggest names to kind of pass in recent years.
It felt to me it was just an acknowledgement of how complicated and thorny so many of the issues that he was a representative of actually are still in society. I mean, because it was once we heard the news of his death, you were like, oh, okay, what I immediately thought was like, all right, athletes that now have social consciences, like that's still a huge issue. There's the race issues that we still are dealing with in sports. And, you know, the conscientious objection is not one that athletes have had to deal with in our generation. But, like, it was such an interesting moment to kind of see how we always reflect on somebody after they've passed, and we almost want to whitewash it. But then for me, immediately realizing that whitewashing it would not do justice to who Ali was.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the thing that I think he expressed most profoundly was self-determination. And in some ways, all these hot takes we talk about, right? Like, LeBron shouldn't be able to stack the deck and go to Miami, or Derrick Rose should get back on the floor, like he's getting paid millions of dollars, or seemingly every conversation about sports that gets people really heated is, well, you can kind of boil it down to self-determination of the athlete, whether we're talking about the salary cap and or anything else. And to me, he was the great avatar for that. Beyond just the socio-political stuff, beyond the cultural stuff, it was this notion, and he was one of the very first athletes ever to do this, which is, wait, I'm the one in control. My talent drives the value of this sport. It's not the holy NCAA. It's not the 30 rich guys who own these 30 teams. My talent drives the value of this product, of this experience. And it was more than just being theatrical. It was, again, I think it was self-determination. And he, in every debate we look at, you can, in some sense, trace it back to that notion. And he fashioned it.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things from our perspective here, trying to think about ways to write about it at 538, since this is like such a stats-centric approach that we take to journalism, and our impulse is always to try to quantify greatness, but Ali sort of... He was the greatest in part because of, you know, he let the results speak for themselves, but he also did the speaking for his results, and he called himself the greatest and kind of, you know, left it, instead of him having to prove it, the burden of proof was on others to kind of prove that he wasn't the greatest. Do we think that, you know, in boxing, it's a sport that is kind of resistant to statistical analysis, that is that why Ali was almost able to step into that void and kind of make his own greatness by shaping the narrative for himself?
You know, one of the things that Ali also does, I think, is remind us, and I bow at the same altars you do, Neil, right? Like, I'm a stats guy. I was born and raised on the baseball abstracts, and I'm generally on that side of most sports debates. But, I mean, one place that I think we all should make more allowances for is the two debates aren't mutually exclusive. If we talk about Allen Iverson, we can say in the same breath, might have been statistically overrated and, by the way, a profoundly important cultural figure within the confines of the sport. And actually, I would argue outside the confines of the sport, right? And I think the beautiful thing about Ali is it is a reminder that we can have a multifaceted conversation, that no one is saying that the statistical analytics-based argument is the judge, jury, and executioner. And by the way, no one is saying that we should only take into account a guy's cultural import or his gut or his grit, or just watch the games, man. Like, I think to me it was a reminder for all. In fact, I think it's a place that we could all agree on, which is that we can measure greatness in several different ways. And even if you disagree with like the order of criteria, that it is multifaceted and we can all appreciate.
And I think also, though, Neil, when it comes specifically to a solo sport like boxing, it's like the challenge that Ali has in front of him in every bout is simply to beat that other guy no matter what happens during the middle of each round. If the end result is him winning, really that's the most quantifiable statistic, in like the boxer's mind. And there's less of an ability to compare, because like we always say, well, we can't compare, you know, it's hard to compare eras. It's hard. I would think that it would be hard for us to analyze from bout to bout, two different fighters in one bout, two different fighters in another. So that is a kind of sport where you can create your own narrative, and there aren't like the inner working pieces of analysis that we can do in baseball and basketball. That would be my thinking on it. How do you feel when you look at boxing as something to analyze from a statistical perspective?
Yeah, our sports editor here at 538, Kyle Wagner, actually wrote like a really great piece over the weekend in response to it, where he talked about Muhammad Ali's greatness defying statistics in a way that, like you said, Kate, that when it's an individual, there isn't room for these kind of flourishes, especially in an era in which Ali fought, in which they didn't even have, you know, those kind of fun, but kind of we don't even know how to interpret them. CompuBox stats where it's like left hooks landed, roundhouses landed. They didn't even have that back then. So all it was the W's and L's, if you will. And that kind of leaves little room for the nuance of, hey, this guy is a really underrated player on a good team, because the ratedness of a person becomes what their win-loss record is. And he also pointed out that fighters have almost kind of, it's circled around and eaten itself, maybe to the detriment of boxing, that a fighter's one-loss record becomes his entire identity, and preserving that undefeated record long enough to kind of cash in on one of these big-name bouts, and preserving it by fighting lesser fighters and dodging people that might be able to blemish it, and really only with the payday in mind, it made me think about in college football where, you know, your non-conference schedule is not really compelled by anything, and they've made it a little bit better with, you know, the advances of the BCS and the Final Four that they have now. But back in the day, you used to be able to play pretty much nobodies in non-conference, and if you're an independent, you could kind of pick and choose, and that led you to have inflated one-loss records, and it became impossible to really know who was truly the best, and that's kind of to boxing's detriment now, is that you have a lot of phony one-loss records, and you can't use that objective standard to define greatness, so you have to fall back on some of the less objective things that might be better anyway when it comes to a sport like this.
Yeah, it was interesting. I as a disclaimer, I'm not a huge boxing person. Like, I don't know a lot about the intricacies of the sport. I was a Tyson era fan, mm-hmm. As a kid. But I was thinking about Ropadope, because that is something that particular fight is, because of its cultural import, actually, I probably know more about and have seen. And I was just wondering, as somebody who's not familiar with analytics and what it's been able to accomplish or not accomplish in terms of letting us glean information about the sport, is it possible that was one of those situations where it was sort of the equivalent of allowing an inefficient volume shooter to sort of do their thing and let them beat themselves? Like, I was trying to come up with, okay, if we were to apply sort of an analytic narrative to a great fight like that, was that, because it's often regarded as his sort of genius, right? Like, let Foreman wear himself out, right? Like, that in some ways, as spirited as that fight was, in the context of that fight, obviously, is what we'll all remember, is the trip to Zaire. But I was always wondering, was that a situation where maybe stats wouldn't have told the story because his sort of intuition that night was so profound and was able to win him a fight? But I think analytics might look at that fight and say, well, who had more punches, right, with connecting? And again, this is where I'm out of my depths.
No, I think that is a great analogy, because it does seem like, you know, analytics at their most primitive form are just about counting things. But I think a lot of times when they run into trouble, it's about counting the same, treating two different things as the same, because you don't have enough of a fine-grained definition of what to count and how to count it differently. And so it's entirely possible that you would have said, because he was outpunched so much, somebody years later without the benefit of watching the fight would have looked at a stat sheet and said, oh, he got outpunched in that fight. He was lucky to win, when that doesn't tell, that tells the totally wrong story about it. And to a certain extent, like we said earlier, it doesn't really even matter where Ali ranks because of how he shaped the culture of athletes in subsequent generations. And on that note, we're going to leave it there with our tribute to Ali, and we're going to move on to soccer. So we're going to say goodbye to Kevin for a moment. He stepped out due to the overwhelming soccer content of this segment.
That's scary.
Yeah, he'll be back after this to talk about hot takes. But first, we have to talk about the Copa America. It's in, America. It's in the U.S. this year for the first time ever. But that does not mean that the U.S. men's national team is actually doing well. To help us parse their defeat to Colombia and their potential early elimination, we're going to welcome back Hot Takedown's international global soccer correspondent, Mike Goodman. Did I get that right, Mike?
That's close enough. Okay. I'll take any title I can get.
All right. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
First of all, I have to ask, does the U.S. look like they're leaving their own party before it's even begun?
I think it's probably too early to say that they're going to necessarily be eliminated. They still have a really good chance of moving through, but they got to win now. Like, they've used up the wiggle room with the loss to Colombia, and they got to beat Costa Rica or at least draw for Costa Rica, but probably beat them and then go from there.
And Mike, as somebody who was there and then talked to everybody afterward, it seemed like the sentiment afterward from the guys and from Klinsmann was like, look, we got unlucky, right? We got unlucky on two plays with the penalty, which they were saying, you know, wasn't a handball, and the set pieces and different things like that. Do you feel like it was like, hey, look, we got unlucky, or is the U.S. just not playing well? Or maybe there's some middle ground there?
Well, I think it's both. And I think in context, you know, the U.S. hasn't played good soccer for a while now, probably going on 2 years since the World Cup. So it's sort of hard to hear from Klinsmann and the team, oh, we played just as well as they did and we got unlucky again. Even if it's kind of true, right? I don't think that Colombia played appreciably better than the U.S., and they definitely got – look, you don't need to go back and relitigate every handball call. There's a lot of leeway in the rules and how they're called. Was it a tough call? Yeah. Was it an unfair call? No. And those things happen, and the bottom line is, in general, you need to be good enough to get results despite those things happening, and the U.S. weren't. But that doesn't mean that they weren't, like, mostly okay. But it's a short tournament, so you have no more time for that.
Yeah, is mostly okay kind of what we're looking for at this point? Like, under Klinsmann, wasn't the U.S. supposed to kind of progress more than this? I feel like mostly okay is kind of the standard that we've been holding up for a long time now. Is it safe to say that the team has been kind of disappointing over the last year plus?
Oh, absolutely they've been disappointing. And if they hadn't been disappointing, you would walk off, you know, that result to Colombia and say, all right, it's a one-off. Colombia is a pretty good team. It happens. There's no reason to worry. But given that really for two full years now, since they got eliminated from the World Cup, mostly okay has kind of been their ceiling. And last summer in the Gold Cup, which has probably been the only really competitive matches they played since the World Cup, they were awful. So there isn't sort of any trust or faith or goodwill that they're going to bounce back from an okay performance and get to, you know, a higher level that we might expect them to if they've been playing better otherwise. It's a big concern.
When you look at the ELO ratings for this team, and obviously ELO ratings is a metric that 538
our favorite
uses frequently, the ELO rating for this team now is as low as 1 equal to when Klinsmann took over for Bradley, and then also basically equivalent going back to like 99 when Arena was coaching the team. Like, it's at that same sort of level. Now, on one hand, you can be like, all right, well Klinsmann clearly it doesn't have this team headed in the direction that we need it to head. But at the same time, Klinsmann was the coach in 2014, as you mentioned, at the World Cup, where the ELO rating was at an all-time high for this team. And so if that's what our peak moment is supposed to be, supposed to be peaking, I keep saying we because we're all Americans, but when this team is supposed to be peaking, do we then give, as somebody who follows this team regularly, do you give the leash to Klinsmann and say, he had us at that peak, what we're really trying to do is peak for 2018 again, and this is all part of the process? Or has he really sort of like lost the grip on where this team needs to be?
All right. I think there's two ways to break down that question. There's how much talent does he have to work with, and how close to that talent level is the team playing? And he was brought in mainly with a long-term goal in mind to increase the talent of the U.S. team. And that's a task that has all sorts of big picture issues associated with it, right? You know, there's development issues, there's recruiting dual national citizens, there's cultural issues. And the idea was, like, you bring in somebody like Jürgen Klinsmann, who is a famous name and star in his own right, and he has the time and space to enact a giant, sweeping, long-term goal.
What do you mean by long term? Are we talking 4 to 6 years? Are we talking like, or are we talking though decades when you say sweeping long term goal?
A big picture reform of U.S. soccer is the kind of thing that takes decades.
Right.
For Klinsmann, we were talking like two World Cup cycles in which you say, okay, the day to day results don't matter as much. Let's put us on a path towards becoming a bigger, better, more powerful soccer nation, better using our resources and all of those things. But you have to balance that, right? And you have to balance that with, to a certain degree, results. And it's one thing to say, you know, for a year after the World Cup, oh, we don't really care about these matches. We're trying out new players. We're experimenting. You Americans are too uptight about worrying about results in exhibition matches, whatever, it doesn't matter. And then you get to the more competitive matches, you're putting a burden of pressure on yourself to demonstrate that there is some sort of an interim end game, right? You can't just say, don't judge me for 8 years or 15 years. You have to have these milestones along the way. And last summer and now this summer are both sort of significant milestones, and the team has not performed.
So, Mike, does this kind of represent almost like the composition of this roster seems to be maybe in some ways like a transition point between what you were talking about, the short-term kind of developmental and maybe even like the past generation of players like Clint Dempsey in particular. And then we also have Christian Pulisic, who is 17. We talked about him on the show a couple weeks ago. You know, is maybe more emblematic of the style of play that that Klinsmann might want to play down the road. Is it fair to call this sort of like a transition point, and maybe then that means that Klinsmann it can't be fully held against him if the team disappoints, or are we past that transition point, or is this just one in a string of plausible things that could be described that way?
It's one in a string. And what Klinsmann has done, either intentionally or not, is seem to follow transition point with transition point with transition point. And you know, there's sort of a history in U.S. soccer fandom, U.S. soccer culture of, like, continuing to look for that next big star thing, you know, going back to Freddie Adu, Julian Green at the last World Cup. There's a kid by the name of Gideon Zalalem who has occasionally been brought in. Now it's Christian Pulisic. And I think there's good reason to believe Pulisic is a great and talented prospect, probably definitely with – you'd be more optimistic than him than any, about him than any of the other names I mentioned. And there's a lot of good young U.S. talent. But when you're looking at Klinsmann, you're looking at not only the talent, but you're looking at, okay, we need specific points to coalesce that talent into something resembling a finished product.
Okay, so final question is just at this point, after losing to Colombia, what does the U.S. need to be respectable at the tournament? What from this point forward could kind of be considered a salvaging of the tournament?
So before the tournament, Klinsmann said get to the semifinals. I don't think that's changed. They still have every chance to get out of the group stages. They need to do that. Otherwise, it's an utter failure. And then it depends sort of what your quarterfinal matchup is. But you're looking at something to point to and say, yes, this is the vision. This is what we see. Because it's been a really long time since, you know, U.S. soccer followers have had anything resembling that sort of touchstone to point to.
Okay, thanks, Mike. We're going to leave it there, but we'll check in as the tournament goes on. And like you said, Kate, we're all kind of Americans here. We're all rooting for the U.S. team. So hopefully they'll be able to pull that off and maybe make it out.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, guys.
Again, Mike Goodman writes about soccer for ESPN. You can find his work at ESPNFC.com. And finally, as we welcome back Kevin after his soccer hiatus. Okay, no Sig Dig this week. Instead, we want to help our friends out at Slate's podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Their host, Stefan Fatsis, is on the hunt to find a definition for a term very close to our hearts. Take it away, Stefan.
Now, one of the challenges of defining is cramming a lot of complicated ideas into a concise package that reflects how a word is used in speech or writing, and only that, descriptive, not prescriptive. So I searched for and read through dozens of examples of how hot take is actually being used in Google, Google Books, Nexus, other databases, and I collected a few that might be included with the definition to illustrate the phrase. Finally, I wrote a few drafts of an actual definition, and so far I have settled on this. Hot take, noun, a strongly worded, provocative, or sensational opinion. I'm not wedded to or satisfied with my hot take definition, so I am turning to you, listeners, for help. Does my definition of hot take need to be broader? Does it need to be more nuanced? Does it need to allude to or directly address the sarcasm angle? How would you define hot take?
So what do we think of Stefan's definition of a hot take?
I mean, I like it, but I'd also have to add in that it's an opinion that also can basically be like reading a headline over and over and over again, but in various incarnations. So you're like, you know, LeBron James is a fraud. He just doesn't show up at crunch time. LeBron James is weak in the fourth quarter, okay? All he does, LeBron James, is play well for three quarters or play well for the regular season, but he doesn't show up in the postseason. See what I did? I just reread the headline
without actually adding in
any information at all. No actual facts to back up my statement, just a reassessment of the headline.
It's that great, like there's that great line from, I forget which West Wing episode it was in season one, where it's like, you just said three things that all mean the same thing.
That's what it is. It's a brilliant art.
Do we want to account for hyperbole? And maybe that's, maybe provocative implies hyperbole. I don't know. But to me, at least the cultural baggage now with hot take, and again, in our world, like hot take is almost an insult. Like if we're on a podcast together and I'm like, hey, Kate, that's a hot take. It's a slight backhanded compliment, if that.
It's not even backhanded. Like I would straight up be like, Kevin, why would you insult me so much?
Yeah, it's almost like the hotness of the take is inversely proportional to the amount by which it can be supported or backed up. And that goes to kind of the hyperbole factor that you were talking about, Kevin, I think.
There's just like turning your back on any sort of gray area. You just have to pick a side. It's in a way like a boxing match. You have to get in one corner or the other, and you can't allow for the fact that maybe I want to be in the middle.
Okay, so Kevin, how would you define a hot take?
I don't have a dictionary definition, but I did pull my favorite hot take of all times, and I think it's like a proto-hot take. It's hot takes before there were hot takes. It was hot takes before like WFAN even got on the air. This is 1983, and it's from one of our luminaries. It's from Bill James, and he used to write these capsules in these like a player capsule for every major league starter in his baseball abstracts, and in 1983, he basically ranked Ozzie Smith only the fifth best shortstop, like in Major League Baseball. And yet this was like at a time when, you know, Smith was essentially an MVP, top two or three MVP candidate.
Right.
And it just absolutely bewildered him. So he writes this long, it would be basically an essay. I mean, it's got to be at least it's got to be at least 1,200 words, maybe 1,500 words. And it includes the following sort of nut graphs, if you will. The argument for Ozzie Smith as National League's most valuable player shine with a pristine logical clarity unpolluted by evidence. And then he goes on and says, you know, basically there's this entire coterie of people who are saying, well, Ozzie Smith saves you 100 runs. He might not hit for power, but he saves you 100 runs. And basically James's response to this is, the deal you see is this. For 100 years, baseball has been buried in a blizzard of records. On every season, it has fallen. And yet people are so fond of talking about these large factors in the game that don't happen to show up in the records anywhere. Clutch hitting, hitting behind base runners, saving runs with the glove. Can't you see how absurd it is? It's like saying that there are a bunch of elephants playing in the snow, but they left without leaving any tracks. If there was an elephant in the snow, he's going to leave some tracks. If there's 100 runs out there Ozzie Smith is saving, I can damn well find their tracks. And he just goes on, and it was sort of at a time when, like, no one really wrote like this, which is the hot take not from sports writer up on high daily columnist standpoint, but like somebody actually making empirical arguments but really putting some heat behind them.
Yeah, that's almost like a proto hot take down, right? Like the people backing Ozzy with the 100 runs, those were the hot takes that were unprovable.
So.
And Bill James was offering the antidote.
But it was strong. He, like, all through this book, he is throwing heat. I mean, he basically calls Sparky Anderson full of shit in this book. I mean, it's amazing.
So Kate, so we know Kevin's favorite hot take. What is your favorite hot take? Do you have a great example that you've encountered over the years?
You've already heard that. Basically, I feel like it's like a headline that you read in various incarnations. I also would define it as a strong opinion weekly held. Which,
oh, interesting.
Ooh, I like that.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing for all of us to learn in the sports media world, right? Because those do get a lot of clicks. But yeah, strong opinion weekly held. I just picked the most recent one I could find, which shows the basically rereading your strong opinion again and again in various ways. And this was like a radio announcer talking about Jessica Mendoza. Jessica Mendoza is the worst baseball announcer who has ever announced the game of baseball. If Jessica Mendoza continues on, I believe someday they're going to have to replace her, unless the ratings are okay, but I don't care. What I do know is I shut the sound down to watch that game. She's just not a good announcer. I listened for an inning last night, and I had to shut it off, and that's the God's honest truth about it, period, end of story. So basically, we just heard three different ways that Jessica Mendoza is the worst ever, with actually no assessment of what makes her the worst ever.
Wait, was that like a comment board, or was that like somebody was paid to write those words?
It was like it's a transcript from a radio station host.
Oh, okay.
After listening to Sunday Night Baseball.
Yeah, okay. It seems like one of the quintessential bits of it is, like you said, Kate, you have to almost use your subsequent one retelling of the same thing as though it is evidence to support your previous ones, even though it really is just the same thing.
And the diction's even fascinating. A baseball announcer who's ever announced baseball or whatever it was.
That in and of itself is circular.
Like the tautology is kind of brilliant in its own kind of way.
I think we have exhausted our hot takes and our own definitions, but we would like to give a shout out to the audience and just ask anybody who wants to send us your definition of a hot take and send us your favorites. And we'll send them on to Stefan and see if we can help kind of crowdsource this definition of a hot take. And you can email those to podcasts@538.com. Okay, that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Neil.
And thanks to Kevin Arnovitz for being our guest, our pinch hitter.
It was a pleasure.
He saves 100 runs a year with
I save 100 runs a year with my glove.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast grandmaster is Jody Avergan. We receive production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, or all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Please subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song was by Mystery Mansion. I'm Neil Payne. Talk to you next time.